Stanton Friedman received his B.S. and M.S. degree in physics from the University of Chicago. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist on advanced, highly classified, eventually canceled projects such as nuclear aircraft, fission-fusion rockets, and nuclear power plants for space. Stan is the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, who co-authored Crash at Corona and instigated the Unsolved Mysteries Roswell Project. Stan has provided testimony to congressional hearings, appeared twice at the United Nations, and pioneered many aspects of ufology, including the Betty Hill star map work, crashed saucers, and analysis of the Delphos physical trace case. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Stan, how are you, my friend?
Tired. It's late here, George.
It always is. But you know what? You love this. You'll stay up because you're the best at this.
Flattery will get you everywhere. I'm a Leo, George.
You know, the one thing in our careers together, I have never asked you. I mean, I know the nuclear physicist. I know all this. What got you interested in unidentified flying objects?
Well,
what happened?
It was strictly by serendipity, I guess. I was ordering books from a mail order book place in New York, Marlboro, I think it was, back in 1958 as a young physicist working for GE on nuclear airplanes. And I needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping. And there was a book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, by Captain Edward Ruppelt, who had headed Project Blue Book in the early 50s. This was in 58. And it was marked down from $2.95 to $1, hardcover book. And it wasn't going to cost me anything because shipping would have been that. So I figured, heck, it's not costing me anything. It'd be worth a laugh if nothing else. B, the guy works for the Air Force. They were co-sponsors of our aircraft nuclear propulsion program. That year, incidentally, GEANP for Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion spent $100 million on the program. We employed 3,500 people, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. So it was a big program. And see, you know, if these things were real and I didn't have an opinion, I have even then had a big gray basket, I guess you could say, then maybe it would help our program if they worked on nuclear energy of some sort. So I bought the book, read it. It intrigued the heck out of me. It didn't convince me, but I shared it with a neighbor. Charlie was 10 years older than I was, and he was an engineer, and he was more impressed than I was. Well, we went our separate ways. I moved out to California. ANP was down the tubes. I got out just in time. Had a good librarian. I read about 15 more books, some of which were utter trash. And if I'd read them first, I probably wouldn't have read another one. And I found a document at the University of California, Berkeley Library, Project Blue Book, Special Report 14, a privately published version. And it shook me up because not only was it the biggest study ever done, data on 3,201 sightings, hundreds of charts, tables, graphs, maps, but the guy included the press release that went out in 1955 about the study, and I found that he was lying through his teeth. It was the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald Quarles. And, you know, I was working under security, so I understood when you sort of evade things, you know, you avoid giving classified information.
Sure.
But when you flat out lie, that got to me. He said that on the basis of this study, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. I mean, everybody recognizes there are really only three categories of sightings. UFOs turned into IFOs, identifiable flying objects. That's the great majority. Those reports for which there isn't enough information. And finally, the good stuff, the unknowns, the reports by competent observers of strange phenomena in the sky or on the ground, which the observer cannot identify, which remain unidentified after investigation by competent investigators, and which we furthermore judge to be manufactured based on the way they look and to be manufactured elsewhere than on Earth based on the way they behave. Well, when I looked at the data in the report, the unknowns were 21%, not 3%, and they were completely separate from the sightings about 9.5%, that were listed as insufficient information.
That's a huge jump.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking about rounding off numbers here, a little arithmetic here. We're talking about blatant misrepresentation. In addition, and you had to go through this report. I was in data heaven. I like data. I mean, that's my bag, if you will. When you go through the report, you find they did a quality evaluation of all the sightings. And it turns out, the better the quality, the more likely to be unexplainable. 35% of the excellent cases, the cream of the crop, could not be identified. Now, if you were looking for a cure for cancer, and I told you, well, I guess there isn't one after only 20% of the chemicals we tried worked, and yeah, of course, 35% of the best ones worked,
mm-hmm.
You'd say, hey, all I need is one. What are you saying? There's no cure, you know. So how many good UFO sightings do you need? I mean, sure, it'd be nice if one landed in the middle of the Super Bowl or something, or World Series. But, you know, short of that, we have one heck of a lot of data. The study also, the guys who did the study, was done at Battelle Memorial Institute, although I didn't know it at the time because their name isn't in the report. But they did a cross-comparison between the sightings that you could explain and the ones that you couldn't explain, the true unknowns. They looked at things like apparent size, color, shape, speed, that sort of thing. And what they found was the probability that the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. So this is just highlights, but that report really shook me up. And then by some kind of serendipity, a little hard to believe when I look back, I was project engineer on a contract out of the Foreign Technology Division of the Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is where Project Blue Book was.
Interesting. Did you work on anything that was strange, Stanton?
Well, just the title of this study was Analysis and Evaluation of Fast and Intermediate Reactors for Space Vehicle Applications. Now, the word that was missing was Soviet. My job was to look at the best data I could find on Russian work in all the technology areas that might lead you to build a nuclear system for space, a reactor. And the people who gathered all this data, believe it or not, were Battelle Memorial Institute, the guys who did Blue Book Special Report 14. So I was going back there every month or two for a year and a half or so, got to know the people at BMI, was very favorably impressed, and got, because they were in the same office, Blue Book was in the same office as Foreign Tech Division, I got to see them on these trips, too. So, you know, it was Air Force data that convinced me, strange as that might sound to people, but it's there. And I've been talking about Blue Book Special Report ever since then. And like I say, the original press release didn't even say who did the work, didn't give the title of the report. I got a kick out of that, because surely if they had said, the press release got very wide distribution, but if they had said Blue Book Special Report 14, surely some newsman would have said, what do you mean 14? What happened to 1 through 13? We've never heard anything about them. The answers would have to have been they were all classified. So they didn't even give the title of the report. Apparently none of the media asked for it or the people who did the work. But because of what I was doing, I found out who did it and where it was done and even met some of the people. So it was a strange combination of circumstances, if you will.
When I met you, Stan, it was 1971. I think you were speaking at Oakland University in Michigan.
Michigan, yes.
How many conferences and speeches have you been to now over those years?
Well, I figured it's over 700 colleges and another couple hundred conferences, technical groups, that sort of thing. And, hey, look, what got me going, what convinced me that I had something useful to say, started with a talk at the Engineering Society of Detroit. I mean, that's not a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes, you understand.
That's right.
They were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk.
Do you think that would happen today?
Yeah, probably. I get good responses when they sell the sizzle of my professional background. And what I'm getting at is that there was no negative questions from that group, incidentally. And it was response of things like the Engineering Society of Baltimore and Cincinnati, also overflow crowds. half a dozen sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics and of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, a talk at the American Nuclear Society section at Los Alamos, which Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab paid for me to go to. They were requested to do so, and they're a corporate member of the American Nuclear Society. But still, it's interesting to look, and I hear guys talking about, oh, they're so afraid if they're professors, even though they've got tenure, they're afraid of speaking up, you know?
Right.
Gee, don't mention my name. Well, I asked Westinghouse, which is where I was working when I gave my first lecture, and after I did a whole bunch of these chicken and pea circuit stuff, and everybody wants free programs. They're not free anymore, folks. I asked the company, I said, look, I need some guidance here. I've got a clearance, I've got a family, I've got a mortgage, I've got a house. I don't want to lose my job. I want to do more talks. What's the basic rule here? So my boss talks to his boss and so forth, and they get back to me, and they say three things. They said, you can say what you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. But we would like you to start each lecture with a disclaimer. The views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer.
Well, all right.
Now, could you ask for anything more than that?
Nope.
And then somebody did ask. A guy I knew at Los Alamos called me. Somebody was also working on nuclear rocket radiation shielding work. We'd like you to speak to the local section. I said, it's fine with me. He said, no, I mean on an expense account, Stan. I said, well, I don't make those decisions. So I asked management, and they knew. I mean, this was all up and out in the open. It wasn't
sure.
A hidden conference, you know, where I would sneak in a talk. And they said yes, and they paid my way.
And are they still around, by the way, Westinghouse? Did they get gobbled up by somebody?
I don't know. My group doesn't exist anymore because I was working on the nuclear rocket program, and that got went down the tubes, too. I have a history of working on more canceled government-sponsored programs than anybody.
Were they reverse-engineered, Stanton? What do you think?
No, not the programs I worked on. It was nuclear airplanes. That was obvious after the war, as a matter of fact, that if you could build a sufficiently high-performance system, a nuclear reactor and appropriate shielding, you could have a plane that could fly for thousands of hours without refueling. You know, submarines go around the world. I mean, the aircraft carriers, they replace the fuel every 18 years. So it would be an enormous advantage if you could do it. And that was obvious after World War II. Now, they didn't start big on the program until 1956. There were small study efforts before then. But we were spending lots of money. The same thing with nuclear rockets. It was perfectly obvious if you could take liquid hydrogen and heat it and kick it out the back end of a nuclear rocket, you could have a very efficient system. And we operated them on the ground, ground tested. The biggest one, about 7 feet in diameter, put out a power level of 4,400 megawatts.
Wow, that's huge, too.
That's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam, to give you something.
Yeah, exactly.
7 feet in diameter.
What has been the reaction to you when you go on some of these conferences? You know, I just saw you at the Bay Area UFO Expo. You've got one coming up at the Crash Retrieval Conference in Vegas over the November 10th weekend. What's the reaction, Stan, when you meet people or when they hear your lecture?
I give different lectures. As a matter of fact, in Halifax on October the 13th, 14th, the Saturday, there I'll be giving a talk on flying saucers and physics. Paul Kimball asked me to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Grateful for that. The other talks aren't about high technology. And at the Crash Retrieval Conference, my talk will be different. It'll be the UFO why questions, W-H-Y. Because, you know, people don't have much trouble with accepting data when you take it from government documents and such, but they still want to know, so why are aliens coming here? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? And, you know, a whole bunch of why questions. Now, my standard college lecture, if you will, is flying saucers are real. And, well, I'll give you an example. Last year, or earlier this year, actually, before the Aztec UFO conference, I spoke at Pikes Peak Community College in Colorado Springs. The interest was so great. I did several media interviews there. But the interest was so great that we had to schedule a second talk that night.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, you know, it's not just me. I mean, yeah, they've seen me on television. You know, people have a strange impression, George. They think I get paid for all those television shows and all those radio shows. You mean you're sending me a lot of money every time I'm on, right? Sure.
Yeah, right. You know what? And that's why, you know, a lot of people don't understand. I mean, researchers like you live off your website and, you know, the periodicals, the books, and the DVDs that you produce. You don't get paid from our shows. You don't get paid from the TV shows.
I had a guy call me and said he wasn't sure he ought to because I was obviously just in it for the money. He'd seen me on so many television programs, and he was shocked when I said, you know, I didn't get paid for any of those programs.
What? Ronnie, I think I had to lend a tie to you once before one of your speeches. I can't remember. Stan, you know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that the reaction has been very good. I got a whole bunch of letters. Even put up a sheet with letters from Northeastern colleges and from far Western colleges and a whole one for Texas colleges. The reaction is good. I've had 11 hecklers in all of those lectures, and two of them were drunk, George. And I say this not to pat myself on the back, but to try to get people to understand, even though you've been mythologized that nobody believes in flying saucers and they'll think you're a kook and whatever, that isn't really the case. The polls have shown the greater the education, the more likely to believe in UFOs, and that believers outnumber non-believers. Of course, there's a group that says, I don't know, you know. But in a poll that was done of engineers and scientists, two-thirds of those who expressed an opinion said they think they're real. So the nasty, noisy negativist, when I'm being polite, I use those terms, would have you believe that nobody believes in UFOs and there isn't any evidence and it's all a kooky story and stuff. When you get down the check, you find that that isn't the case at all. And, you know, I'd get that many hecklers if I was talking about sports, religion, politics.
Maybe more.
I don't know. So I would say that the response is good. I am not a masochist. I've had no eggs, no tomatoes thrown at me, And so,
how about government plants? Are they in there taking notes?
You know, that's an interesting question. I would say they seem to be aware of who I am. I've given talks with Air Force colonels sitting right next to me at a dinner. So they pay attention. And although I'm thinking I tried to get my files from the FBI and the CIA under freedom of information and privacy. I mean, I live in Canada, but I'm a Canadian citizen now, but I'm also an American citizen. So many years ago. Yeah, I'm a dual citizen. And when I go this way, when I go into the U.S., I'm an American. When I come back, I'm Canadian. When I go overseas, I'm Canadian too. Because, well, I think you know why.
Yeah, I know why.
I filed and told them all the details. You know, you give them as much information, my full name, my date of birth, my social security number, the fact that I had a security clearance for 14 years and so forth and so on. And I want my files. I get back a letter from the FBI. We don't have any files on you. Now, I knew that they did my security clearance and two second time around updates, if you will. So I knew they were lying, and it made me angry. But then I got the response from the CIA, which was funny. They said, all we have on you is a negative name check request from the FBI. And they had a file number with it. They sent me a little copy of this little squib of paper. So I sent it to the FBI, and I said, could you check your files again? It would appear that you made a request, and here's the file number of the CIA, so presumably you have a file on me. I get back a letter saying, well, we've checked again, and yes, indeed, we do have a file, but it's classified. So I write it back saying, how big is it and what's the security level? That information was classified.
Stay with us, Stanton. Back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Stanton Friedman. A couple hours of Stanton Friedman. Last hour, we'll take phone calls. Stan, how about evidence? Is there anything out there that convinces the world that we are being visited by these extraterrestrials?
Well, if I judge by the questions that I get after my lectures, the large-scale scientific studies that I present, seemed to impress a lot of them. I've mentioned one, Blue Book Special Report 14. Data on 3,201 sightings is a lot of sightings, quality evaluations, all the rest of that. There was also, believe it or not, the University of Colorado study. You'd think it was just debunking from reading the headlines, but 30% of the 117 cases they studied could not be identified, according to a UFO subcommittee of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And it wasn't UFO believers. I wanted to be on the committee, but they wouldn't let me. I was biased. I had reached a conclusion after 11
right.
years of study.
Disqualified.
There's the congressional hearings of 1968, a long time ago, but doesn't change the sightings that were dealt with.
What motivated that?
Jim McDonald managed to talk some congressmen Jim was a great scientist, the University of Arizona, professor of physics in the Department of Atmospheric Physics, Institute of Atmospheric Physics. And he got intrigued in the early 60s, and then he really got it involved, and he visited NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And then he visited Project Blue Book, and he found so many good cases there that were either explained away or pretty much ignored that he became a champion for a scientific look at UFOs. There's a wonderful book by Dan Druffel called Firestorm, Jim McDonald's attempts to bring the scientific community into the ufology world. And he died a tragic death, but before he died, he managed in his congressional hearings, and he was the one who pushed to get the hearings, and six scientists testified in person, including Carl Sagan and Dr. J. Allen Hynek and so forth, and I testified in writing only. I am proud of the fact I was the only one without a PhD out of a dozen. So you can't give me a free degree. See, I couldn't complain about those guys if you did. Anyway, in Jim's paper, he's got information on 41 separate cases, including multiple witness reports, sightings over big cities, sightings by astronomers and meteorologists, radar visual cases. Did an outstanding job in investigating those cases. And the report, I've listed it as a separate entity on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, because for anybody who says, well, there aren't any good sightings, just lights in the sky at night, well, that's nonsense. There's great cases. And at my lecture, I also talk about the UFO evidence that Richard Hall put out and then put out an update 40 years later on it, almost 40 years later, which has, 746 unknowns in the first edition out of 4,500 cases. A lot of data. And then there's J. Allen Hynek's book. He was, after all, the scientific consultant to Project Blue Book for over 20 years, and his book, The UFO Evidence, got more than 70 cases that couldn't be explained. So when you look at sources like that, it's pretty hard to turn it down because all the objections, there isn't any data. Well, I check my audiences, incidentally. I'm sneaky.
After each
of those studies that I talk about, I show a slide and tell them about what's in it. And then I ask, how many of you have read this? And if I get 1%, I'm lucky. I mean, occasionally 2%, you know. But so people are impressed, and then when you look in the other direction, physical trace cases, I hear people saying it's just anecdotes. Well, a radar case is not just an anecdote, for goodness sakes, but the physical trace cases, Ted Phillips in Missouri, I don't know if he's ever been on your show, but he's certainly worthy of being on. Ted's collected over 5,000 physical trace cases from 70-some countries, I don't know what the latest number is. These are cases where the saucer is seen on or near the ground, and after it leaves, one finds physical changes, the equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks, sometimes small footprints. I'm not talking about crop circles here, where almost never do people see a saucer to go with the circle. And about a sixth of these cases involve reports of small beings being seen with the vehicle.
See, that's what fascinates me, those occupant sightings.
Yeah. Hey, they're out there, and you might say, well, gee, if they're coming here, how come we never see the beings? Well, people do see them, and of course, there's over 1,000 abduction cases that half a dozen great investigators have looked into, Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs and John Mack and people like that. And so the evidence seems to have no difficulty convincing people. The problem is most people think that most other people don't believe in flying saucers, and so they have to act accordingly.
What's the latest data on that, Stan?
What?
What's the latest data on that in terms of polling?
Well, I don't know what the latest is because everything depends on how you word the questions. But I tried a little experiment at a college campus years ago, about 100 students, and I said, look, I want your opinion on some things, but I don't want you to be influenced by your neighbor. I want you to close your eyes and vote with your hands, and the instructor and I will count the votes. And so it turned out, to make a long story short, that 80% of them, the students, thought that most people didn't believe in UFOs, and yet 80% of them did believe in UFOs. But it turns out, of course, that our actions are pretty much determined by our perception of how other people will respond. And so when you close that gap between the real world and the imagined one of noisy negativists, and this is pushed all the time by these guys, then you see that people are ready, willing, and able to believe because the facts are there. You know, 10% of the people at the end of my lecture, I'll ask, and the hands go up very hesitantly. I ask, how many of you believe you've seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer? And I've asked, define my terms at the beginning. And the hands go up hesitantly. They know I'm not going to laugh. I mean, lectures, flying saucers are real, underline and capitalize the R. but they're not sure about the rest of the audience. Anyway, 10% of the people raise their hands, and I point my finger and say, 1, 2, 3, I count out loud. By the time I get to the other side of the hall from which I started, the hands go up much more readily. But then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down.
Way down, yep.
Yeah,
I
and
think that.
Then I do something else if it's a good-sized group. How many of you were in the military at the time? If there still is a hands up, I say, you want to tell us about it? And then I get some great responses. One guy in front of 1,300 people in Texas says, I can't. They told me not to say anything, which is a wonderful line. I had a guy in Indiana say, they took my pictures. And everybody's waiting for the rest of the story, you know, and he doesn't say anything. So I said, look, you don't need to stand up. I'm not asking your name, but I'm sure the audience would like to hear the rest of the story. Everybody clapped. So he sat down. He didn't stand up. And he was flying a four-engine plane in the Air Force out of the Pacific, plane ahead of them 20 miles, radioed back, saucer heading your way. They had gun cameras. They took pictures. They radioed the base to which they were flying. When they landed, the film was taken, of course. Pilots don't take film to the drugstore, incidentally.
No.
I've had people suggest, well, how come the pilots don't show us the pictures? They never get to see them. And then they were debriefed and told never to say anything. So you get enough stories like that independently. I don't use them in my lecture, and, you know, I don't have any documents to show anybody. But if you get the same stories all over the place, people aren't lying to you independently and coming up with the same stories.
Why do you think, though, you know, Hoagland, when he's on the show, Stan, talks about the Brookings Institute and the fact that,
yeah,
the, you know, their study basically concluded that we can't handle the truth. Do you subscribe to that?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, though, I should add that I'm absolutely convinced that there was a classified version of that report. You know, that was an unclassified study. I say that because it was my experience. I mentioned I did this study about Soviet nuclear plants in space with Battelle. Well, I put out two final reports. One was unclassified, just a bibliography of appropriate technology. The other one was highly classified, my analysis of what I learned meant. I don't have a copy of that, never did have one. I mean, I turned it in, that was that. And I must say I was very glad that I was correct, because when Cosmos 954 came down in Canada, that proved that it had a nuclear reactor on board. And it was the 13th one that they had launched. We've launched one, incidentally. And I see somebody's calling me, and I didn't give it out my number, and it must not be anybody I know. So.
They're already tracking you down, Stan.
Yeah, on my website, I suppose. Please
why don't you
call
by the way,
until later.
I want to
tomorrow.
get into some great cases, but why don't you? You don't want to give out the number yet, then?
Well, I can give it
that's
out
right.
as long
well,
as.
Why don't you? I'll tell you what. Give the mailing address first. Let's do that.
Yeah,
just give that.
That's better. You can write me at Stanton Friedman. Post Office Box 958, Houlton, H-O-U-L-T-O-N, Maine, M-E, not M-A, 04730-0958. That's Post Office Box 958, Houlton, Maine, 04730-0958. And I still have my George special, George.
What is that one?
Both of my books, Crash at Corona, The Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident, and Top Secret Magic, second edition now, mind you. Well, I added 5,000 words to the first edition to deal with all the objections by the noisy negativists. I think we clobbered them all. But and my CD-ROM, UFOs, The Real Story. The whole package, including priority mail for only $35. It's at least a $45 value plus shipping, but $35. We take checks or money orders. On my website, you can use PayPal. Some people like to use that. Some people swear against it instead of swearing by it. I don't know about you, but I hear comments both sides of the fence. You know? But and that's a good starter place. There are other things listed on my website. But I also want people to use that address. If they know anything about Roswell, maybe their grandfather left them a piece of strange material and they don't know what it is. Well,
so you're still looking for Roswell data, aren't you?
Well, I'm still looking for Roswell data. I'm also looking, you know, it shows that I'm an old man in the field because I keep getting asked to do the forwards for books. One of them, the new books that'll be out hopefully by the end of the year, maybe, is Shoot Them Down by Frank Fascino Jr. He did the...
He did the Flatwoods Monster. Yeah, he did a good job with that, too.
Yeah, well, because of that, we started digging into all the reports of crash saucers and all the indications that UFOs had taken out some of our planes, and then finding that orders were issued in 1952 to, if they don't land when instructed to do so, shoot them down. And so, you know, I wrote the foreword for that, and that'll be out. But in there... It's clear that there were, how shall I put it, a dark side. There was a dark side to this whole business. I've talked to at least seven people who have quietly told me of situations in which more pilots went up than came back down. That's a little scary.
It is scary.
And I did a column in the MUFON Journal and UFO Magazine, Zapped Aircraft, I think I called it. And a guy calls me and said, you know, he hadn't thought about it for years, but an old buddy of his from Purdue University, way back in the early 50s, who'd come back from serving in the Air Force as a pilot in Europe, had told him when he asked about UFOs, all he would say is, we lost 20 planes to UFOs.
20 planes, Stan?
20 planes. And I've already read the new book by Tim Good, Need to Know. It's not available in the States yet, but I got a copy from Tim. I sent him a check, and he sent me a book. And apparently the same thing was happening that he heard about, independently of my sources. So I'm looking for more stories like that. Obviously, the guys who got splattered across the countryside aren't going to write me, but there may be a crew chief, you know, somebody on the ground who knows about that or was listening on the radio when they reported and then they disappeared, stuff like that. We'd sure like to hear from those people because, you know, the public needs to get a handle on this. And I know there are some people saying, oh, come on, they couldn't keep that secret. We lost airplanes. Well, you look at the New York Times for the first few years of the 50s. Well, over 200 planes crashed, George. That's a lot of military planes going
down.
It
sure is.
And they used words like disappeared and disintegrated. You know, that's kind of scary. And what I found most intriguing and scary, too, was that there were three pilots who had over 100 missions in Korea. where the MiGs were trying to shoot them down, you know? They come back, and they crashed in the United States where there weren't any MiGs. That seems more than coincidence. Three guys, your best pilots? I mean, you don't survive 100 missions in Korea without becoming a pretty darn good pilot. So, you know, I say dark side. Now, the people who say, oh, come on, they couldn't cover that up, I would refer them to a book, By Any Means Necessary, by William Burroughs, B-U-R-R-O-W-S. 2001, he was a reporter for the New York Times and Washington, New York Times and Washington Post, and then he teaches history someplace back east. Anyway, this is the story of the hidden deaths of 166 American military air crew members who were in reconnaissance planes that were shot down approaching, sometimes over, North Korea, China, Russia in the 40s, 50s, 60s. You know, they would dash in to see how quickly the Soviet radar came on and what frequencies, the tickling, they called it. Well, 166 men got lost. These planes had big crews because of all the electronics on board. You know, sometimes as many as 15 people in one plane.
Of course,
there were observations, and there were radio reports back, and there were guys who bailed out and apparently got taken prisoners and tortured. Not one word in the American press about that. It was only in 2001 when the government had a big meeting, brought in all the families, and gave medals. But up till that time, none of the families had been told the truth about what happened to their sons, husbands, fathers, whatever.
Do you think Spielberg, when he did the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, had this kind of data, had this information, maybe from NICAP at the time, who knows? Or did he just make it up, and was he very perceptive?
I think more the latter than the former. He did, Alan Hynek was a consultant on the film, and NICAP had been very active. I don't think he had really inside information. He may have gotten some later on from people who, knowing what a job he did on that and on E.T., might have told him, you know, because they knew he wasn't going to laugh at them. And you've heard, of course, of his remark to Jamie Chanderay that when he brought E.T., I guess, to the White House, that Ronald Reagan had told him quietly that maybe only six people in this room will know the real story. And, you know, I wish I had been there, but I wasn't, so all I can tell you is what Jamie told me. But
and you got to believe him, right?
Well, I dealt with him for quite a while, and I found he's a very honest, hardworking, and so forth guy. We worked on MJ-12 and so forth, so, you know, it wasn't just a quick 2 minutes with him.
I'll be back with Stanton Friedman in just a moment on coasttocoastam.com. Then in our last hour, the third interview hour, it'll be Open Lines with Stanton Friedman. Stanton, you have said all along that we have a primitive society, so why come here if you're an extraterrestrial?
Well, my paper has lots of reasons. One is that we are the densest planet in the solar system. I'm not talking about the people now. But
I was going to say their mental state or what?
No. The cubic foot of Earth weighs more than a cubic foot of any other planet in our solar system. That means more heavy metal here. And heavy metals are peculiar, that is, they're not very common in the universe. We know from studying the spectra from stars. And I'm talking things like gold, uranium, rhenium, osmium, platinum, rhodium, tungsten, much, much heavier than lead, incidentally. And so they may be mining the goodies here. They may be here to mine the asteroids and checking us out at the same time. Or, you know, it's kind of funny. We know that at the bottom of the ocean there are nodules of all kinds of good metals. But, you know, our nuclear submarines are used for carrying nuclear-tipped missiles so we can retaliate if somebody attacks us from under the ocean. We're not recovering those minerals. They could be graduate students doing their thesis work on the development of a primitive society. You're a broadcaster. They could be having weekly broadcasts, Idiocy in the Boondocks. And there's a whole long list of these. The one I like the most, really, I mean, in other words, you got to stand back and say, what are people doing at O'Hare Airport? Are they all there for the same reason? Of course not. They're there for sports competitions and to visit Aunt Minnie and to, you know, see a girlfriend and all kinds of business deals, all kinds of stuff. Going to Las Vegas or Hawaii, you know, these are not exactly business trips, but to have fun. And the kicker here is that, you know, you wouldn't think about going to Las Vegas if you had a walk from where I live, for example. I mean, it's a long way to go and would take a long time, and I don't get that much time for a vacation. But if you can fly there in a few hours, that's different.
It's worth
so
it.
If these guys have more advanced propulsion systems than we do, which seems reasonable considering we've only had technology for 100 years in a neighborhood that's at least 5-6 billion years old, the big reason I think they're here, I mean, all the other stuff is aside. You know, we have motherships coming here that are half a mile long. They probably have, you know, 100 Earth excursion modules on board, and each one doing a different task. We're somebody's colony, we're somebody's crop. You know, they're studying languages, and they're picking plants and doing genetic studies, all the rest of that. But I make one assumption about every advanced civilization that I think is a reasonable one, and that is, it's concerned about its own survival and security.
True.
You know, we on Earth are spending $1 trillion on that sort of stuff. I mean, some of it's nasty, but still. And if that being the case, you have to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives who show signs of being able to bother you. And at the end of World War II, after a century of development which made clear we were moving along, you know, blast furnaces and all kinds of other things, putting out chemicals that clearly indicate this is not just an agrarian society, cavemen or whatever. At the end of World War II, three signs that soon we'd be moving out, which I think would scare the heck out of any visiting alien. These guys? We don't want them out there. The three signs were nuclear weapons, which pollute the atmosphere in ways that are easy to measure with air sampling.
Which we've really perfected now, I guess, since the days of World War II.
Well, yeah, I would think so. I mean, they tell you a story very quickly. Secondly, V-2 rockets, remember during the war, from Germany to England in a hurry with explosives, not with friendship letters. And three, I'll call it radar as an example. Sophisticated electronics. You know, we used to have AM radio. The signal stuck within the atmosphere, obviously fairly primitive. But suddenly, the development of electronics during World War II moved along very, very quickly, radar being perhaps the best example of that. And you put all those together, and uh-oh, these idiots are going to be bugging us. Now, isn't it amazing that the only place on the entire planet in July 1947 where you could study all three of these was southeastern New Mexico? Trinity site, first atomic bomb, was it July 16th, 1945? After the war, we were firing captured German V-2 rockets there, and that's where we had our best radar to track the rockets, which somehow didn't always go where they were supposed to go.
And were those von Braun projects in Germany?
Were they what?
Werner von Braun projects, those rockets from Germany?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Werner von Braun was, and remember, he came to head up the Saturn V program, too.
Yeah.
Because of him. Yeah, he was brought over as part of Operation Paperclip.
Yep, that's true.
And, of course, they violated a few rules. Supposedly, you couldn't bring over any scientist who had been connected with the Nazis, and we said, we don't care about that. We need these guys. If we don't get them, the Russians will get them.
Yep.
And so, incidentally, that gave us a real hold on the guys who came over, because if they got sent back, they sure as heck didn't want to go to Russia. Not once they'd been in the United States. You can imagine that, you know, Russia lost 20 million people during World War II. The place was destroyed.
You remember the day, I think you had a debate with Seth Shostak, remember, on our show?
Oh, I remember very well.
And in the poll, you won. Question, Stephen Greer has said on my program and with Art on the Weekend repeatedly that there are signals that have been picked up by SETI and that he has SETI sources that tell him this is indeed the case. Now, according to Seth, there aren't a lot of SETI sources. There's only three major guys there. And also, he told me once again, we did not pick up any signals. And he said, George, if we do, we want the world to know about it.
Well, certainly would help job security, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So based on some of that and the fact that, we don't have the disclosure of who's saying this, in this particular case, do you think Seth is the one telling the accurate story?
Well, I hate to admit it, but yes. Well, I say that because even though Seth constantly will mention UFOs, it's obvious he doesn't know anything about them. And that was obvious when we were on the program doing the debate.
Right. He believes in life out there, but he just doesn't believe it's here.
Yeah, they're not coming. Look, if they're coming here, who needs SETI? I mean, think about that for a minute.
Good point. They've bypassed
it. I can find no support for Steve's position on this. And he says something else that bothers me. He says we've discovered, figured out, developed free energy that would save the world, all kinds of oil and pollution and all the other things that would come if we had free energy. And I haven't seen any signs of that. I mean, free energy is one of those terms that bothers me. Yeah, the wind is free, but the windmill isn't. The sun is free, but the solar panels aren't free.
Exactly.
And neither the sun doesn't shine all the time, and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So, show me and I'll believe it. And, people have been talking about free energy for, 20, 30 years. And a lot of times you have a guy build a tiny little device and say, see? But scaling up from small to big is fraught with difficulty because some of the problems, the mass goes up, the weight of the thing goes up as the cube of the dimension. The drag goes up as the square. So, when you build it bigger, it doesn't mean it's better. It may mean that it's worse at doing what you want. So I have had no indication that we have received signals. you understand that there are all kinds of radio signals out there from all the satellites.
Quasars and everything else, too.
Well, yeah. The universe is full. Although, interestingly, did we know that before we had radio receivers?
No, we didn't.
So there's an interesting story there that illustrates one of the problems, and I didn't use this in discussion because I hadn't heard the story. But in that book that I mentioned, By Any Means Necessary, they tell how a German general in 1939, before the war started in Europe, not long before, it had been informed that the English were building these tall towers over 200 feet high, and they had cross members. And even though the Germans were talking about using these round dishes for their radar, they figured this must have, it's got to be radar. And they're all aiming across the channel. So he wanted a slow plane to fly along and check them out, but he got the Graf Zeppelin, which is 700 feet long, but moved at about 70 miles an hour. So they meandered a parallel to these in a line parallel to the coast, listening and trying to check to see what kind of radar the British were developing. And you know what? They didn't get any signals. However, the British, it was radar, and they were tracking the graph all right. The kicker was that the Germans were using a frequency different by a factor of 10 from what the English were using. Now, the Germans, who have a common ancestry with the English and the same technological background and are only a couple hundred miles away and have spies over there checking on things, if they couldn't correctly predict what frequency the English were using for their radar, and they never did catch on to the fact that the English were monitoring all their flights of everything, if they couldn't predict it, how can we say what an alien civilization is using as the latest in communications? I have great difficulty with that notion. When you consider how rapidly technology changes, look back 100 years, George. Weren't nobody on a radio
dramatic
talk show, I'll tell you that.
Dramatic.
And well, no computers and no microwaves, no nuclear, no DNA, a whole long list of things.
Well, what kind of propulsion system, because you've worked on them, do you think they would be using to get here and to get back home, or maybe to a mothership?
Yeah, I think we have two different problems here. Think of an aircraft carrier. When we were bombing Vietnam, we had carriers staged off the coast. And they would carry about 75 little airplanes that would go out, bomb, come back, refuel, go out again, come back. They'd fly a lot of sorties, as they called it. Well, considering the difference in environment between the space between the stars, which is a lot of nothing, pretty close to nothing anyway, and to be in the vicinity of the Earth in the atmosphere, where you've got air pressure, which leads to heating when you're going fast, mm-hmm. when you've got high gravitational field, all the problems of an atmosphere and weather, I expect, based on the wonderful reports that we have of huge motherships, space carriers, if that sounds better to some people. You know, think of that case in the Yukon where it was triangulated by a civil engineer, Martin Jasek. It was between 0.6 and 1.2 miles long. That big. Anyway, so we have two separate problems. I think within the atmosphere, probably something close to magneto-aerodynamics. Now, one of Friedman's many laws is that technological progress comes from doing things differently. Obviously, the notion of carrying along something you throw away to provide propulsion isn't very efficient. You know, when you think about it, that's what airplanes do.
Well, that's true. And cars and everything else.
Yeah, you use the fuel to lift the fuel to lift the fuel, et cetera. That's not too sharp. So if you can ionize the air to make it an electrically conducting fluid and have electric and magnetic fields, then you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile. These are all boundary layers. You know, that's what happens where the object meets the atmosphere that affects everything.
How about wormholes also as a traveling mechanism?
Well, wormholes might be useful for the long distance part. I mean, the thing is that, you know, going the speed of light in the atmosphere doesn't make any sense. It takes a seventh of a second to move around the planet all the way. How do you meet somebody for lunch at that speed, George?
That's true. Well, you don't have to worry about picking up the check either, Stan.
Well, that's true. That's true. So between the stars, on the other hand, is an entirely different proposition because the distances are much greater. You know, it's like I don't get out of my house and onto a 747 in the backyard. I drive to the airport, I take a small plane to a bigger airport, and then I get on a 747. Well, the big motherships, I think, the easiest suggestion to make, even though I think they work by techniques about which we know nothing because we are ignorant, we're not advanced, we haven't been around very long, the obvious thing is one I worked on more than 40 years ago, nuclear fusion. Now, fusion is something we know a lot about. It's what gives us the energy from the sun. That's how all the stars operate. So every advanced civilization is going to know about fusion. We figured out how it worked back in 1937, I think it was.
How come we've never used it?
Well, we do use it. H-bombs use it very nicely.
I mean, in practical sense, not
okay.
To destroy.
To produce electricity, you got to be economically competitive. We know how to do that already with coal and oil and nuclear power plants. The first, to make show that the system works, you'd need to build a big one, costing a few billion dollars. Nobody wants to invest that kind of money unless they're sure it'll work for 20 years, you know, 25, 30, whatever. And also, too many physicists and not enough engineers. We like doing physics experiments, and there is a small amount of work going on in nuclear fusion. And, you know, back in 1975, well, give us 15, 20 years, and we'll have the problem solved. Forward 10 years, give us 15 or 20 years, and we'll have the problem solved. What are we saying now? Give us 15 or 20 years, and we'll have the problem solved. We haven't put a lot of resources in it, and we need the engineering more than we need the physics. But nuclear fusion for propulsion in deep space, where nature gives you a nice big vacuum chamber, the systems we were looking at in a big study we did for the government were deuterium, that's heavy hydrogen, and helium-3, sort of light helium. Now, these are the two most abundant isotopes in the world, hydrogen and helium, and the two lightest, which makes it very convenient. Right. But the nice thing is, if you react those two, you get charged particles, and they have the beauty of being able to be guided by electric and magnetic fields, whereas neutrons, which we were looking at for the earthbound systems go out in all directions, and they're a pain in the butt. You've got to absorb them, they produce heat, and then, you know, you've lost all the advantage. So we looked at nuclear fusion, and it appears that if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles off the back end, that only have 10 million times more energy per particle than they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. That's something we know about. And incidentally, we have small controlled fusion devices, little accelerators that we put down oil well boreholes to find out how much hydrogen is around, which tells you how much oil and gas and stuff like that is around. You can buy these. I mean, they're not cheap, but and you can't use them in your backyard.
Right.
But, I mean, there are limits on the stuff that you use. But
it'd be nice, though, if every home had its own system where you were self-contained and what the electricity you didn't use, you just sent it on down the grid.
Well, yeah, and but that's one of the problems with the free energy, with solar and windmills, is that we don't have a way to store energy. In other words, in the middle of the night, what are you going to do with it? That's the nice thing about nuclear power plants. You base load them, you run them 24/7 and run them for a year. That's been done, incidentally, longer than a year, actually. But and that way you don't need to worry about storage, and you turn on and off the coal fire and the oil fire and the natural gas fire and stuff. So fusion is one technique. Then you get into all these other things, you know, string theory and
wormholes. Yeah.
Yeah, wormholes and white holes and black holes and all this stuff. Now, an important point to make here is that I'm not saying that when a craft lands on our planet that it just came from home. You know, the mothership may be stationed out in the asteroid belt. There may be a base on the backside of the moon.
Sure. It's all possible.
Yeah. When I go anyplace from Fredericton, we have direct service to, Halifax, Montreal, and Toronto and Boston, four cities. So when I went to that Whole Life Expo, I had to take three planes to get there. My longest lecture tour, when I was a young man, I must say, I did...
Hold the story, Stan. Let's take this quick break, and we'll be right back. Stan, did you want to finish the story you were talking about being a young man,
yeah.
I guess, in college?
This business of where you're coming from when you show up at someplace strange, I once did 25 lectures in 35 days in 15 states.
Right. That's a lot of traveling.
When I was younger. I saw spring come in three times that year, different parts of the country. I was never home from the time I left the first time until I finished all 25 lectures. I didn't go out, back, out, back, out, back.
And so, you just kept going and going and going.
Yeah, from A to B to C to D and right on down the line. And so we don't know that aliens aren't doing the same kind of thing. And I should make another point here, too, about, you know, why I come here and all the rest of that. In any one century, it seems very unlikely that there's more than one civilization in the neighborhood going through this very rapid change from being stuck on your own planet to being able to bother somebody else. In other words, we would be of concern to everybody in the neighborhood. Now, one of the places where Seth Shostak and I disagree, I don't think we're the crown of creation. I think there's life all over the place out there, and we're like the gorillas in the nature preserve in Africa who haven't the faintest idea what's going on around us. The SETI people seem to feel that the nearest, there may be another civilization 1,000 light years away. And, of course, they're going to send a signal to attract our attention. Now, I have no idea why. What are they going to learn from us? We're not the most advanced guys on the block, clearly.
Unless
in other words, everybody out there is either way behind us or way ahead of us.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that.
You know, it's a difference of approach, but it's funny how they've moved the distance that they expect the first signal to be coming from 50 light years, 100 light years, a few hundred, now it's 1,000. And, you know, they think they're being optimistic when they say there's 50,000 civilizations in the galaxy. Well, considering 200 billion stars, that makes us one of a very select few. That's where they come up with 1,000 light years to the nearest one. Well, I think they're, like Carl Sagan said, billions and billions of galaxies, because they ignore colonization and migration. And I don't think you can ignore that.
Who has had the most impact on you, Stan, if anybody?
That's an interesting question. My heroes, if you will. Jimmy Doolittle was a hero of mine, and Admiral Rickover, and Van Bush. Now, Jimmy Doolittle, a lot of people don't realize he was really Dr. Doolittle. He had one of the first PhDs in aeronautics from MIT way back when. He was one of the world's finest flyers. I mean, everybody's aware of that. And he was gutsy, 30 seconds over Tokyo. But what they may not be aware of is that it was part of his contract with Shell Oil after the war, and he was a vice president, that he could spend up to half his time on government stuff. And he wasn't looking for glory. He had his glory. Ike asked him to do a study on the CIA. Now, nobody's ever seen that study, but there is mention of it being done.
Right.
There was a West German intelligence agent who came to the United States, talked to a lot of people in a lot of places, went back and defected to East Germany. Who did he ask to clean up the mess? Jimmy Doolittle. Also, he had a UFO connection. He was asked, apparently, to talk to the Swedish Defense Forces in 1946 about the ghost rockets that were being seen all over the place that summer in Scandinavia. And I had located him. He was still alive in his 80s. And Bill Moore went to speak to him in California there. And he remembered everything about that trip to Europe except what he did in Sweden. There was a little article in the New York Times about him talking to the Swedish defense officials. But so he's one of my heroes. A strange name for a second one. I mentioned Admiral Rickover because he was gutsy. He's the guy who practically pushed us into having nuclear submarines.
Oh, yeah, and handpicked the crew for every sub.
Yeah, I mean, and he liked to pick people smarter than him, he said. And he also had to fight the battleship boys who were trying to tell Congress, you don't want to build submarines. Build us more big battleships.
Put more planes on it.
And, you know, the interesting thing
aircraft is, carriers, yeah.
Yeah, big targets, I think you could say. But the interesting thing is that the Polaris missile wasn't designed until after we had the nuclear sub. In other words, they didn't have the missile, and let's see if we can find a vehicle for carrying it. But, hey, look what we can do. Hey, you know what? Maybe we could put a missile on that because it can stay under the water. They've actually gone around the world underwater without coming to the surface, which is pretty remarkable. So he fought against the odds. So that's why I liked him. Another hero of mine was, of all people, Jackie Robinson. I grew up in New Jersey where, you know, the three New York teams in baseball, and I was a Dodger fan as it happened.
Did you love baseball? You love baseball?
I used to. I don't pay as much attention anymore. But the kids were all real fans, and there weren't so many teams. The same players stayed with the team for years, not like today.
In my day, like you, I think I remembered the players on every team back in the 60s.
Batting averages and all the rest of it, you know. But Jackie Robinson, because he was a guy who not only had great talent, but who had guts. Despite all the obstacles, he did extremely well. And if a black man in 1947, the year of Roswell as it happened, could do well despite all the troubles, then a Jewish boy in New Jersey might be able to make it too, you know, if you push forward.
I love it.
It was an example, and, you know, for those who don't recall that this ever happened, when Jackie Robinson was on third base, he drove pitchers crazy because he did occasionally steal home. Now, when was the last time you heard about somebody stealing home?
It's been a long time.
But, you know, so I was very impressed with people who had talent and made a difference, but who had to have courage to go with it. And, you know, maybe that's why I'm not afraid to speak out. Why should I be? You know, what have I got to lose? My job? I'm my own boss.
And speaking of speaking out, Colonel Corso, what do you think of that in his going public through his book to just
tell
people?
You know, I wish I knew the whole story there, and I don't think we'll ever get the whole story. I met Corso a couple of times. Nice old gentleman. I met his son, too. If people go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and Friedman is F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. I had somebody complain he couldn't find it, but he was spelling Friedman wrong.
Friedman.
You won't get it that way.
Yeah.
I have an article about him, a piece about him, and I think he exaggerated his role, and I think there's a tendency to forget that the Air Force Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, with whom I had direct dealings and was a big outfit, unlike the two guys in Corso's outfit, had wreckage in 1947. Now, Corso didn't go to work for General Trudeau and their foreign technology group at the Pentagon until 1960.
Yeah.
I cannot believe that those other guys did nothing. Also, he was not an engineer or a scientist. And he took credit for a couple of things that we know where the work came from. A guy even won a Nobel Prize in 1958 for his work in 1958. So I think he overstated his role, which is probably why Strom Thurmond took away his foreword, you know?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
It was really for another book. Also, from talking to Bill Burns, we once talked about this. I had pointed out that Colonel Corso had signed a sworn statement that he had been a member of the National Security Council. Now, I checked at the Eisenhower Library, and he was never a member, never attended a meeting.
Hmm.
And talking to Bill about that, I mean, I got a letter from it and showed it to the attorney, Peter Gersten, who was going to file a suit on Corso's behalf to get all his files, you know?
Yeah.
And he showed it to Corso and said, should we take that out? And they said, Corso and his son said, no. Well, that's not a good place to start if you're going after the government and you give them wrong information. So that, among many other things, made me feel that he was exaggerating. You know, he called J. Edgar Hoover a good buddy.
Yeah.
But his
yeah.
FBI files say Hoover called him a rat. I don't call rats good buddies, I don't think. And so there were a lot of – he was a liaison with the National Security Council. That's very different. You know, it's like the bat boy for the Dodgers did work for the Dodgers, but he wasn't the same as Jackie Robinson or the manager.
Far know? From it.
So,
but the kid had a good heart, right?
Yeah, yeah. And what a nice way to put that. So I'm not a big fan. And if one thing that's missing from the book is references, is specific names, places, all the rest of that stuff.
Well, do you think he was delusional?
I think he came to believe a lot of this stuff. I think he wanted to leave a legacy for his family. And I think he had, yeah, delusions of grandeur, maybe. I don't mean he made up scenes, you know, in the sense that we sometimes mean that word. But I think he overstated his involvement by quite a bit. And I tried, for example, we were on a radio program. I was in one place. He was in another. The host was in a third place. About how did he come up with that date for July 6, 1947, when he was at Fort Riley in Kansas, you know?
Yes.
And supposedly saw the body. Was it notes or, you know, a diary? No, he remembers when he was transferred there. Well, that was March or April. And that date doesn't seem to jibe with anything else, with when we know about when Mac Brazel came to town and all the rest of that. And the security arrangements, when you got really highly classified stuff, nuclear weapons components, new electronics, the drivers who carry that stuff around on trucks, you don't park the truck out in front of the restaurant and go in and eat your dinner. There's always a guard with those components.
Yes.
You know, like Wells Fargo is pretty careful with what they do with a truck full of money. And so it didn't jive with what military people would tell me would be standard procedures. There was no guard there. And also, this bowling buddy, a sergeant, I guess, took him in to see the body. Now, that's a strong violation of security. Why would Corso have a need to know for that? You know, I worked under security for 14 years. That's something you just don't do.
So you think he had some truth to whatever he said in his book?
Well, I think he may have been briefed on occasion and then sort of dreamed about, well, what if? Now, George Knapp can tell you this. George had me look at something in confidence many before, of course, his book came out, and ask my opinion on it. And I felt the uranium got mentioned in there and so forth.
Yeah.
My feeling was this was done by a guy who didn't have much technical know-how. Now, how do you get sophisticated information into the major industries in the country without good technical know-how?
Yeah, yeah. You can't just plop it on their desk and say, fix this, make this.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. Because I was involved in big programs, nuclear airplanes. We were only spending $100 million a year. I mean, in 1958, though, that was when a dollar
those
was
are
really
big dollars, though. Yeah, exactly.
So, he did get a lot of attention to the field, which is probably good. On the other hand, Strom Thurmond's getting, saying you got to take out that forward. Probably helped sell a few books. Remember about banning a book in Boston?
Yep.
I don't think people don't ban books anymore, do they, George?
Or burn them, I hope not.
No, well, I hope so. So he's harmless, and I understand he didn't make much money out of it, which is unfortunate. The book did sell pretty well, but there were legal restrictions and all the rest of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was well-intentioned. Also, he had said he was head of someplace, White Sands Missile Range or Proving Grounds, and when he'd check, he wasn't the head of the place either. So,
Do you think he was like a Walter Mitty Stanton, who had this?
I remember Walter Mitty. Danny Kaye, one of my favorite actors.
Exactly. Do you think Corso may have that Walter Mitty mentality?
I think he might well have imagined himself what he would have done, could have done. Maybe it's harmless. I guess he didn't hurt anybody. And that's always an excuse, isn't it? Well, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. So, and it wasn't as if he reaped in, loads of money. But and people are still talking about the book, and maybe that's good. But, go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and there is a piece on him.
The effort to unravel UFOs, to find UFOs, very difficult. You've always called it the cosmic Watergate. Do you think that's the cover-up?
Well, I think there is a cover-up, and I call it that because it's a nice cliche, if you want. And
I like it.
When I started using it, everybody knew what Watergate meant. And, I'll give you a parallel. Jim Berkland, who's a geologist who has successfully predicted a lot of earthquakes, including the World Series earthquake.
Regular guest on the old show here.
Yeah. And Jim, what he was really dealing with was a seismic Watergate. How's that? Well, for people listening, I've known Jim for over 30 years. He was at my wedding. As a matter of fact, my wife and his wife have known each other for 40 years or more.
See, you are convinced. I don't know. We get a lot of new people, Stan, that pop in all the time. A lot of people may not know that, you wrote a book called Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C. It's about the Majestic 12.
Yeah. If you want to see wrong information about Magic Majestic 12, go to the Wikipedia article. I couldn't believe it. Somebody referred me to it.
I just found out people enter stuff on Wikipedia, that it's not some official thing.
Well, I got to see what I can do to change. The piece on me, for example, includes the notion that it appears that he only worked on paper studies. Well, I was running experiments at expensive facilities. We built nuclear airplane engines. We operated jet engines on nuclear power. We're spending $100 million a year. I don't consider that a paper study. We did in-pile experiments, tested things at up to 2,000 degrees, which is quite remarkable, inside a reactor for a long period of time. Nuclear rocket program, I had experiments on the NRX-A6 nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system. That was a small one, only 1,100 megawatts out at near Area 51.
Do you think something's popping at 51?
Well, I don't know what's happening at 51, and I defend the government's right to have secret test facilities, and of course we know U2 and SR-71 and stealth and all that. And I suspect the Aurora, and we still haven't come clean on the Aurora. We wouldn't get rid of the SR-71 if we didn't have something better, would we?
That's right.
I can't imagine that. So, you know, but, and people say, well, underground bases. And I say, sure, you want to escape the satellites. And you want to, if there's a nuclear weapon dropped, you just as soon be far down and not on the surface. You know, these go without saying. So there are a lot of underground bases all over the place.
Are there a lot of countries getting UFO cases, good ones, on a regular basis?
Oh, yeah. Basis? Yeah, it's an international problem. And, you know, I've spoken in 16 other countries besides the U.S. and Canada and find great interest in all of these. I was in China. I was in Hong Kong last year.
Did you like it?
Just about a year ago. Oh, I liked it a great deal. And they had a sold-out crowd, standing room only. And I went up to an international Chinese-sponsored UFO conference in Dalian, China. It wasn't as fancy. Hong Kong is a very remarkable place. I was very impressed, and the airport is super.
Stay with us, Dan, because we're coming right around the corner to take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I got to tell you, Stanton, you're a great guest, always always knowledgeable, but more importantly, just a superb individual. So I appreciate you every time you're on the program.
Well, thank you very much, George.
To the show we continue, and let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen. Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, indeed.
Wherever you may be, where are you?
I'm here in Tecumseh, Michigan.
Okay.
A lot of extraterrestrial activity.
A lot of lights there. Go ahead.
I'm 54 years old and was born in August after the events that took place in Washington, D.C. Do you remember that in 1952?
Oh, yeah. That's an important part of Frank Ficino's book, Shoot 'Em Down.
Yep. And my parents were heading down the Indian Head Highway when I was still in my mother, and they were abducted for a while. So I know I've always been under observation. And I've followed through on this and learned as much as I possibly could about it and had a lot of interesting experiences and seen a lot of things. And so I can remember a time when, Stanton, when you were a mild naysayer in the process of being interviewed on television and stuff. And I wanted to ask you, what made you turn the corner so you became a believer?
Well, I don't think I was ever a naysayer. I may have been neutral on occasion, but and it's certainly true that I have been naysaying about certain stories that I had heard. Robert Spencer Carr, I think his name was, comes to mind about bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and stuff. And that was before I started doing research on Roswell. So I'd heard, I'd knocked stories that I didn't have any evidence to support. When I got evidence, I certainly changed my mind.
Do you remember the Jackie Gleason, Richard Nixon story, Stan? Is that true?
Oh, yes. I do remember the story. And, you know, I tried to check on that. For the listeners, basically the story goes that Jackie's wife, ex-wife, I guess, at the time, wrote that they played golf together on occasion down in Florida. And Nixon took Jackie onto a military base there and showed him bodies.
Homestead, Florida.
Homestead, you know, which got clobbered by a hurricane. I forget which one. Hazel, maybe? I don't know. And I tried to follow up on that. Now, in the first place, I do know that Jackie was very interested in UFOs and other strange phenomena. I got that from Merv Griffin, as a matter of fact, who was in a position to know. Secondly, I contacted through one of the unions that show business people belong to. I found his agent who talked to his lawyer who told me that he had checked with the wife and she said the story wasn't true. But on the other hand, it's plausible in the sense that there was a program on television, UFOs Past, Present, and Future.
Right.
By two guys, Alan Sandler and the guy who wrote the book, whose name escapes me at the moment, but that's what happens when you get old, George. Don't get old. I don't recommend it.
I'm right on your heels, Stan, believe me.
Anyway, it appeared that there were plans. Emenegger, Robert Emenegger, that was his name. He told me they got asked to do that show, but he had done stuff for the Republican Party. And so they were asked to do this show using only government data and government people. And the idea was they were going to show footage. The last thing on the show would be showing footage of the alien landing at Holloman Air Force Base with the aliens getting out and meeting military officers and going off together. Now, I talked to a man who worked at Norton Air Force Base where they stored government footage of all kinds. Very dry and so forth out there in California. And he said he saw that footage. So if there were plans to release the data, then it is conceivable that Nixon may have taken Jackie into his confidence with the idea, hey, everybody's going to know this pretty quick. And then, of course, along came Watergate, the political Watergate, not the cosmic Watergate.
Maybe
that obviously would not have been a good time to release the story. You can remember how distrustful people were at that time of the government. For good reason, I might add.
I have not really heard you push the disclosure story in terms of a date all this is going to happen. You have not done that. Others have. They have failed. The dates have come and gone. Why don't you do that, Stan?
Because I have reasons? No data on which to base a release of information. And, you know, U.S. News and World Report many years ago had the word was data was going to be released. That's happened like three times over the years. You know, the stories go around and then nothing happens. So I'm not going to cry wolf. I don't know what's going to happen. Remember that unlike some of the people in the field, I had a security clearance for 14 years.
Yes, you did.
And I know that things don't happen easily. And that there is a national security, there are several national security aspects to this whole question. One of them is a legitimate concern, well, with how will the world react. You know, look at the problems we're having now on this planet from religious leaders either sticking their foot in their mouth, as the Pope did apparently, and then other religious leaders, you know, ready to destroy the world and destroy Israel and all the rest of that. And how would they react? I don't know. But I think that is one concern. Obviously, I think the major reason for the cover-up is you want to figure out how the darn things work. They make wonderful weapons delivery and defense systems, don't you think?
Yep.
Fly circles around anything we got flying. I think you also worry about the other guy figuring out how they work before we do. And every country has an other guy, you know, whether it's India and Pakistan or, you know, look around the world. Rivalries are all over the place. A third problem, and this is probably the big one, is if you make an announcement, it's going to be an enormous push on the part of the younger generation, let's say, for an earthling orientation. I mean, let's face it, from an alien viewpoint, we are all earthlings. But we have a nationalistically oriented society. Do you know of any government on this planet, George, that wants its citizens to owe their primary allegiance to the planet where it belongs, I would say, these days, rather than that individual nationalistic government? I don't.
No.
The United States certainly doesn't want people to think of themselves as earthlings. Canada doesn't. England doesn't. Right on down the line.
We could form the Federation, Stan.
Yeah, I suppose. Now, another problem is you'd have to admit you'd been lying all these years. Who wants to do that? You know, governments don't like to do that. And of course, you could always blame it on the other guy, but, you know, that was them, not us.
To the phones we go. No, I'll let you finish your phrase, Stan.
No, just that, you know, in the present circumstances, would people believe that governments don't lie? Of course not. They know they do lie.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on with Stanton Friedman. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Well, what I have to say kind of ties into exactly what was being said, but it's also kind of an off-the-wall statement/question about what you guys think about this. I've been following along the show for about 8 or 10 years or so, and maybe the UFOs are more than just visitors. What about the possibility that they tie into the spiritual awakening of the world, the apocalypse, the secrets of the government for the simple fact that the government knows what it's about. And it's kind of hard to elaborate in a short period of time, but as they make themselves more prevalent or prominent to us, it's because of what's coming, and they're awakening us to the ending of times, supposedly. And
well, you know, there's all that stuff about 2012.
Uh-huh.
And I forget the exact date. I guess it varies depending on who you read, but which calendar you're using and all the rest of that. But, you know, I can't rule out anything. But my picture is that we're surrounded by civilizations much more advanced than we are. We're the Johnny-come-latelys in the system. And we're a threat to all our neighbors, I think. And I think these guys have a better way of handling things. George, in one of the messages you have between segments, you know, this business of killing people, I would make the case that a truly advanced civilization either learns how to live with its neighbors or it gets clobbered by the very growth of technology. Now, we have demonstrated that we have a lot of technology and not much sociology. Look how we spend our money. Look how many kids
die. It's all military. Yep.
Yeah, every day. And so I think they may know a lot about what's going to happen to us. I think they may know a lot about what has happened, the history in the local library, if you will. And I, for one, have great trouble believing that there weren't advanced civilizations on this planet long before us. Now, if that sounds far out, just realize the place has been suitable for life for a billion years. Now, how much do we really know about the past? I mean, I've mentioned it before in this program, I think, that Hendrik Schliemann figured out where Troy ought to be, the mythical city from the Odyssey and stuff, and the historian said, hey, there was no Troy. If there had been, we would know about it. He was rich enough to afford to pay people to dig down 75 feet, and he found Troy. And that's only from a few thousand years ago. So what about 50,000 years ago or a million years ago? How much of the planet have we dug down 75 feet? It's less than 200 years that we realized there had been dinosaurs on this planet. And you go back 400 or 500 years, Bishop Usher said the world was created on 4004 BC on a Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock. That makes our view there isn't much going on before us. But if you say, oh, it was, a slight mistake, it was 4.5 billion years. Then that changes the picture. So I think we're the Johnny-come-latelys in the neighborhood. Maybe we're the penal colony, George. How's that?
We may be.
You know, they dumped all the bad boys and girls here, and that's why we're so nasty to each other.
Yeah, we may be. Let's go to west of the Rockies. You're on the air with Stanton Friedman. Hi there.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had a question. If he thought maybe anti-gravity be the future of space travel, and if he possibly thinks we can use it as a defense and maybe as a weapon. I listen off the air. Thank you.
Well, a lot of people have talked about anti-gravity for at least 40 years, maybe 50. And, you know, you could consider a rocket an anti-gravity device, I suppose. I mean, it moves you up and gravity's pulling you down, but I don't think it's a very good way to look at things. So I don't know if we'll ever find anti-gravity. Gravity is a weak force, not a strong force. It's pervasive, I mean, all over the universe. That covers a lot of ground. And that's what holds things in place, planets around the star and the stars around the galaxy and so forth. But I don't know how to approach anti-gravity. And I'm not a string theory guy. I can't do the math. And they still haven't shown any demonstrated virtue of string theory. I got to read the new book that's out that says, you know, it's a waste of time. But so I don't know what to do with anti-gravity. It's a nice phrase. You see it in science fiction books all the time. But that's in my gray basket. I wish I knew more.
Wildcard line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead, sir. Okay, sir. Go ahead, Ed.
Okay, this is Ed from Dallas, Texas. Dr. Friedman, I've got a question to ask you about the history of UFOs. You mentioned something earlier this evening about the British and American radar project during World War II, and I just finished reading the book Tuxedo Park about that. And it's amazing to me at the names that appear in the early days of American radar and atomic physics that are also mentioned in the early UFO government documents and publications and everything like that that I've read from the 50s. Would you have any comment about that?
Well, you know, it was a relatively small group of people who were being used in the early days, outstanding scientists. The MJ-12 guys, several of them had worked as scientists during the war. Van Bush was head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, and they looked at radar and the atomic bomb and the proximity fuse and a whole bunch of other new systems. So there's no surprise there. We didn't have a large population of scientists, and we didn't have all the levels of, I'll call it government interference, if you will, but there's a book about the Skunk Works by Mr. Rich, and he pointed out that as things moved on, suddenly there were all these layers of management. Kelly Johnson built the U-2 on budget and on schedule and not a lot of money in something like 11 months. And when Ben took over, Ben Rich, pretty soon there were all these middle guys and then middle guys and all the rest of that. But during World War II, it was amazing how few people did how much work. But they were allowed to do their job. The U.S. built 50,000 ships during World War II. It's amazing. Forrestal pushed all that stuff. But they weren't out there to push paper. They were out there to get a job done. And so it was a small group of top scientists, and they all knew each other.
Well, do you think any of them went to work on the UFO project after they quit the radar project?
Well, it's not a question of quitting the radar project. They all had double lives. Certainly, if you look at people like Jerome Hunsaker, he was head of the NACA, National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, and head of the Department of Aeronautics at MIT. He was a member of the MJ-12 committee. Not surprising. Van Bush, as I mentioned, was head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. He was a member of Majestic 12. Let's see, there was another guy that Lloyd Berkner, very active during World War II. He was Bush's assistant and a member of MJ-12. So you'd go to the best people you have, and that's what's amazing about that group of scientists. As a matter of fact, one of them was a real surprise, Dr. Donald Menzel, Harvard professor of astronomy. What's he doing with this group of high-level people who all had high-level security clearances? You don't need a high-level security clearance to teach Harvard, to teach astronomy at Harvard. Well, it turned out, I discovered at the Harvard archives, took permission from three different people to see his papers, that he had more than a 30-year commitment with the National Security Agency and its Navy predecessor. He was a codebreaker, cryptographer, if you will. He did all kinds of stuff during the war to help the war effort. Nobody knew about that, that he continued this work after the war. They didn't know. So they picked the best that they could have, all people who were proved in the crucible of war, if you will, tested and passed the test. So there's nothing surprising about that, and the same thing was true in England. A lot of double lives there.
All right, stay with us for some final calls, Stan, if you need to get a hold of Stan or read up on him. But StantonFriedman.com, couple related websites already linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. This is our final segment now with our very special guest, Stanton Friedman. Who, Stanton, you would please kindly give us your mailing address and tell us what the Coast to Coast deal is again for everyone?
Yeah. It's Stanton Friedman, Post Office Box 958, Houlton, H-O-U-L-T-O-N, Maine, which is M-E, 04730-0958. The special deal is both books of mine, Crash at Corona, The Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C, all about the Majestic 12 documents. That's the second edition. Both would be autographed, and my CD-ROM, UFOs, The Real Story. You can ask me 50 questions, and I answer them all.
I love it.
The whole package is only $35, including priority mail.
You can send a check or money order or go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and you can use PayPal from there. And also, that's a good address to use, Post Office Box 958, Holton, Maine, 04730-0958. If you know anything about Roswell, maybe second generation, third generation, if you know about pilots who have been lost because of UFO action, because they were
swallowed up, maybe.
What?
Maybe they were swallowed up.
Maybe swallowed up, yes, yes. They were disappeared. How's that as a verb?
Yeah. To the phones we go. East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Michael in Norfolk, Virginia.
Oh, hello, Michael. Good to hear you.
Thank you. I like Stan Freeman's definition of progress, doing something different. And I want to suggest that to him tonight because I think he's our man. A lot of us have been looking for somebody for a long time that we could use to make disclosures through. And he said something tonight that gave me the feeling this might be the man. He said he believes that we are surrounded by civilizations more advanced than we. I have had the impression in the past from listening to Stan that he's kind of an agnostic as far as the Bible is concerned. But those of us in the know on the whole issue that you're talking about tonight understand that the Bible is a primer on intergalactic diplomacy. And when you begin to read it that way, religion goes out the door and progress starts. Now, I was talking to Tom before the break, and I want to ask you, Stan.
Yes.
Do you believe Dave Adair's story about being asked to back engineer a spacecraft at Roswell?
No, I don't.
Why?
I've read a whole manuscript about David and talked to the guy who wrote the manuscript, and I did a lot of checking on my own. For one thing, he talked about firing a fusion rocket and landing it at the Area 51, or I forget which, at either White Sands or Area 51. It doesn't matter. I think he's fired it from White Sands to Area 51. And I will guarantee you that a fusion rocket is not going to work very well in the atmosphere, and that he didn't do it. And people have checked on his story about being at one of the launches down in at the Cape and being in the suite of one of the wives of, what, Hilton, was it? One of those people. Anyway, checking on those stories, nothing checked out.
Would you be willing to appear on the program with Dave Adair?
Well, I'd have to have time to go read his stuff again before I did that. I like to come armed, as George knows, when I was on with Seth, he hadn't read my books, but I'd read his.
Okay, well, look, let me have you follow up on my initial challenge. We can't find anybody in the organized religious world to take on this project of disclosure. They simply don't have the minds to get out of the religious mindset and into a practical, realistic, scientific mindset about what they are reading.
Well, I think you ought to look at the book by Dr. Barry Downing, The Bible and Flying Saucers. And Barry has a bachelor's in physics and a doctor of divinity. Divine physics is his beat, as I've said before. He's a real great guy. He's a consultant to MUFON, and he had his own church in Enwell, New York for 30-some years. And he goes through the Old and the New Testaments. And, yes, he did have trouble trying to introduce other religious leaders to the subject of UFOs. No question about that. But he's certainly knowledgeable about the Bible and knowledgeable about UFOs, a rare combination. Now, You said I was an agnostic. Well, I was an Orthodox Jew as a kid, and that's how my family was, and I was raised that way. I don't practice religion much these days, but I certainly haven't renounced my religion as such. I do think that, you know, it's hard to find something on this planet that's done more damage to the people on the planet than religion has. I probably just alienated, catch that word, George.
Yeah, I'd like
a whole bunch of people, but, you know, look around, look at the wars, look at the crusades and religious wars down through history. So, you know, I worry about that, especially when it comes to people saying, well, religion is great as long as it's mine. You know, we forget that the pilgrims didn't come for religious freedom for everybody. They came here so they could practice their religion. That didn't mean they wanted anybody else to practice theirs in a different way. So I worry about the restriction on people's thinking and beliefs if we get too hung up on religion. And, you know, Barry does a good job of looking at the Bible, and I won't call myself a Bible scholar. There are things about it that interest me. I once said probably 25 years ago, if I were ever to get a PhD, it would probably be on physics and the Bible and flying saucers.
Straight A's on that for you, Stan. Straight A's. Next up, let's go to our west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. I have a question for Stan and see if he could resolve this issue for me. I've wondered why are we not on the metric system with all the rest of the world. I mean, it seems like most of the rest of the world, and we're impeding our engineering and stuff like using a slide rule instead of a calculator.
And, well, you know, I live in Canada, and we are officially metric, although you can still find some pounds in the stores, but kilograms, and the speed limit is 110 out, not far from town. That's kilometers per hour, not miles per hour. And the gas is so much a liter. Too darn much a liter.
Well, when we transferred, when we had the energy crisis, and we could have gone to the metric system on the freeways, changing all the signs, and we didn't do it. And I was kind of curious, why would we impede ourselves by, because the metric system is so much easier to, and it's almost used in the other sciences.
You don't need to convince me. I started using it in my early training in physics, and I'm sold, and like I say, Canada's sold, and don't ask me why the United States doesn't go to the metric system. If I had anything to say about it, I'd say, here we come, metric, you know.
Well, then we'd have to change everything, Stan.
Well, progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way.
Back to the phones, Wildcard Line. Welcome to the show. You are on the air with us. Hello there. Hello. He is gone. Let's go to our next Wildcard Line. You're up. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jason calling from Waukegan, Illinois,
hey,
a.k.a.
Jason.
Buzz the Alien from the White Nighthawk Zone.
That's right.
Stan, do you think NASA is part of this cosmic conspiracy, cosmic Watergate?
Well, it's hard to know what they
know.
Remember, the basic concept is need to know. NASA certainly has done classified work. I've worked on classified programs that were sponsored by NASA. The nuclear rocket engine, they were the sponsor. So people who think that it's all out in the open what they do, it isn't. No question about it. And I'll never forget a conversation I had with an astronaut, Bill Anders, when I asked him way back in the late 60s, I knew him from before the time he was an astronaut, about certain UFO sightings by astronaut. And his answer was very cagily worded. I mean, I had a clearance at the time, and so did he, and we were each chairing session at a meeting of the American Nuclear Society, but his answer indicated to me that he knew more than he could say. Well, I don't think there were any sightings that we couldn't identify. He said it in such a way that I didn't dare to press the matter, because you don't when you don't have a need to know. And I have a friend who knew another astronaut and who had similar conversations with him. And as a matter of fact, I spoke to a NASA group at Downey, North American Aviation, the NASA group. They built the Apollo command module. And it was all a one-way street. They even took my picture with the Apollo 12 command module, I guess. But they wanted to hear what I had to say. They were telling me nothing. So, yes, some parts of NASA, remember the need-to-know concept is basic here. So I'm not saying everybody in NASA knows what's going on. I'm sure some people do, though.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. Next up, Wildcard Line, you're up. It's your turn. Hi.
Yeah. Good morning, gentlemen. Enjoying the show. This is Dan from Chicago, listening on WLS. Stan, I had a question for you. Art had a guest on a few years ago. They were talking about UFOs, and we're discussing a story about William Shatner supposedly having a close encounter experience in the California desert.
On the motorcycle, wasn't it?
Yeah, back in the late 60s. I used to go out riding his motorcycle out in the desert there. After that, had started to investigate, inquire into ufology, and got involved in some of these underground UFO groups. Supposedly was steered towards Heaven's Gate at one point, but thank God somebody steered him off. Although, of course, Nichelle Nichols' brother, I guess, was a victim of that. But I was wondering, if you'd heard anything about that. Can you verify that at all? His interest is...
I'd heard the story. I cannot verify it. And I must say, there was a program that Larry King did out in the desert.
I think Art was sitting in that chair, too. There was a whole group of people. Were you there, too, Stan?
I was there, and Kevin Randall and Dr. Greer and Campbell.
What? It wasn't Art on the end?
Art Bell?
There?
No.
He wasn't there. Okay.
No.
I thought he was.
Right. But they had comments from a whole bunch of people, little bits, 2 minute or less than that pieces. And there was Shatner saying, it's just everybody wanting Big Brother to come down and save them. And I found that a very disturbing and not very bright remark. And I say that even though he is a Canadian, and I'm not saying anything against Star Trek, but it was a stupid thing that he said. And it was clear he didn't know anything about the subject. So whatever his personal experience might have been, it apparently didn't influence his statement on the Larry King Show.
Time for a few more calls. West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, George, and nice to hear you every night.
Thank you.
This is Marcia from California.
Hey, Marcia, go ahead.
Well, somehow it just seems like everybody has some big mystery about this whole deal about the UFOs and civilizations and life forms. I just think that we've been watched for a long, long time, and we might just blow ourselves up, and if we do, we better have someone taking the genetic material and saving it so they can plant it somewhere else in the universe.
How long do you think we've been watched, Stan?
Thousands of years, if not longer. I heard a guy give a paper about, he checked on the myths, if you will, the legends of a dozen different societies, and they had, all of them had stories about beings coming down from the sky, not gods, people coming down in spaceships and beings from above, if you will. So it wouldn't surprise me at all. After all, as I said earlier, you pay attention to the primitives, but close attention when they show signs of being able to bother you.
What do you think of the work of Zachariah Sitchin?
I'm very fascinated with it. I'm not saying that I'm a full believer in what he says, but I've met Zachariah, and I've heard him speak, and he's a scholar. Okay, but I can't translate Sanskrit. And so, or Sumerian. I don't know what Sanskrit.
Tablets, yeah.
Sumerian. And so it's hard for me to evaluate what he said. And I worry about a planet with the strange characteristics that he talks about. Although, we seem to be find a lot of planets way out there, don't we?
That's true. First time caller line, you're up with Stan Friedman. Hi there.
Hi, Steve from Van Nuys, California.
Sure, Steve. Go ahead.
Got two questions. One, I wanted to know what Stan felt about that discovery I heard earlier on Coast to Coast at the bottom of Lake Superior, was it, with the crash?
Oh, the Kinross airplane, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And supposedly the unidentified object that the Great Lakes died.
I'm very much in my gray basket. I've been following the discussion. MUFON has done a lot of looking, and not getting good answers about this Great Lakes Dive Corporation. They don't seem to be incorporated. Their story has changed a few times. I don't know whether that's the Kinross airplane. They are planning to make a movie. And, yeah, I understand you're not wanting to say exactly where it is, but there are rules about recovering wreckage from the bottom of any body of water. It belongs to the people whose it was. In other words, the United States Air Force technically owns that plane. Now, the other thing, we don't know what that is. So I put that very strongly in my gray basket. Sorry.
And real quickly for your last question.
Oh, I just wanted to know if you guys remember a TV show that came on about 20 years ago with Mike Farrell where they did this live UFO thing. Do you remember anything about that show where they talked about
it? Well, I think I was on it in New York, the UFO cover-up live.
Maybe that was it?
It's one of the very few scripted shows I've ever been on. They wanted us all to read scripts that they had written for us. And that's the one that had the comments about strawberry ice cream and Tibetan music, which were the laughing stock of the world for some time. I mean, I'm nothing against strawberry ice cream or Tibetan music, but there was no evidence presented that that's really what aliens like. So, and nobody has ever seen, people were asked to write in with information or so forth, and nobody's ever seen the mail that came in.
Stan, my friend, get some sleep, all right?
I'm going to try to do that, George, because I need it. We old men need our sleep.
You got that right. Thanks again. That's Stanton Friedman. I call him the father of modern-day ufology. If you want more information on what he has done, simply go to the coasttocoastam.com website. That's all you have to do. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.